call the House Committee on Rules to order and open an informational meeting for the purpose of taking invited testimony on the Help America Vote Act by the Oregon's Secretary of State, Kate Brown, and Vice Chair of the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission. Let the record show there is a quorum present. And I guess before I get started, I did want to say there's people in the audience who may be here. We are not taking other testimony, but we will have a lot of conversations about voting and voting rights stuff and those kinds of stuff, and there will be invited testimony at that time for people. So I want to encourage people to keep watching our websites and our others about the different bills that are going to be coming up regarding that, and that they are certainly invited to have that testimony at that time. But today it's an informational meeting. I'm excited to have our people here. With that, I will turn it over to Secretary Kate Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, on the Senate side, for the record, Kate Brown, Oregon's Secretary of State, thank you for the opportunity to introduce our guests today. I also wanted to welcome, there are a few of our county clerks. They're here meeting in Salem during the session, and I wanted to welcome them to Senate and House Rules Committee as well. As the new Secretary of State, I'm truly gaining an appreciation of the role that the Help America Vote Act and the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission have played in improving Oregon's election. We refer to the Help America Vote Act as HAVA. So, because of the federal assistance afforded by HAVA and the agency that implements it, along with some very hard work by elections officials here at home, including John Lynn back to my right, over the past 6 years, Oregon has replaced punch card voting with optical scan voting for one-third of our state voters. We created a centralized voter registration database, and we created a means by which voters with disabilities can cast ballots privately and independently. Each one of these accomplishments represents a significant step forward for our Oregon voters and the integrity of our elections. Today, I'm very pleased to introduce to you Commissioner Gracia Hillman of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. Commissioner Hillman was first appointed December 9, 2003, to serve an initial two-year term with the EAC, and she was one of the first four Americans appointed to serve on the commission, and she is one of the only one of the original four that's still serving. So we really appreciate her diligence and hard work. She currently serves as the vice chair of the commission, and she served as the chair in 2005. She has a perfect background for her current role in the EAC. She served as the executive director of the League of Women Voters of the United States, the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, and the National Caucus Coalition on Black Voter Participation. And she also served as the U.S. Department of State's first senior coordinator for international women's issues, developing agency-wide strategies to ensure U.S. foreign policy promoted and protected women's rights. We are just very tickled to have her here today, and please join me in welcoming Commissioner Hillman. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Chairman Devlin and Chairman Roblin, Vice Chair Berger, and members of the Committees on Rules. As introduced, my name is Gracia Hillman. I serve as Vice Chair of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Mr. Chairman, it is very important, even 6 years later, that state legislatures understand the complexities of the Help America Vote Act. You have the full text of my remarks and other of the Commission materials in front of you, so I will spend just a few minutes addressing some key points. The Help America Vote Act was passed by Congress in 2002. It is Congress's direct response to difficulties that arose with the counting of ballots in Florida following the November 2000 presidential election. It also became clear that other states had similar vulnerabilities. The law is designed to improve the administration of federal elections. It covers all 50 states, District of Columbia, and the territories. Congress appropriated about $4 billion as payments to the states to help them implement the law. Mr. Chairman, let me take a moment to say how much the Commission looks forward to working with Secretary Brown. We enjoyed our relationship with former Secretary Bradbury. We also enjoy our relationships with State Election Director John Lindback and all of Oregon's election officials. They serve on our advisory committees and working groups. They provide thoughtful and informed comment on our proposed policies and draft reports. I believe that the exchange and interaction has been mutually beneficial for Oregon and the Commission. From this point on, I will refer to the Help America Vote Act by its acronym, HAVA. Oregon received about $35 million, against which the state provided a 5% match. These no-year funds must be maintained by the state in a special election account and are subject to federal audits. Interest earned on the money stays with the state and must be used only for HAVA activities. Oregon publicly reports on its compliance in its HAVA state plan and annual reports to the Commission. Oregon is currently undergoing its HAVA audit, which is conducted by our Inspector General. The field work is complete and a report is being drafted now. Before being finalized, the draft will be sent to the state for review and comment. Another important provision of HAVA is maintenance of effort. States are required to maintain its expenditures for certain HAVA-funded activities. Basically, the states cannot use HAVA funds to supplant expenditures they had maintained prior to November 2000. The requirement also applies to local units of government that receive HAVA funds from the state. Mr. Chairman, you will be pleased to know that Oregon seems to be effectively spending its HAVA funds and successfully complying with the law. In July 2006, then-Secretary of State Bradbury certified that Oregon is compliant with Title III of HAVA. Title III prescribes uniform and non-discriminatory election technology and administration requirements. HAVA covers elections for federal offices, but of course, we hope that states will implement improved administrative procedures for all elections. The Title III requirements cover accuracy, reliability, security, and minimal error rates for voting systems. There are voter education provisions for states that vote by mail or use central count voting systems. Additionally, HAVA requires privacy, independence, and accessibility. Other requirements include, but are not limited to, computerized statewide voter registration lists and provisional voting. HAVA provides that the state can determine the methods of compliance. It also requires that voters must have access to a state administrative complaint procedure. Among its many responsibilities, the Election Assistance Commission sets standards against which voting systems are tested and federally certified. Our goal is to provide assurances about the voting systems that states purchase. Mr. Chairman, significant improvements have been made throughout the country. The 2008 election cycle energized American voters in ways that we have not seen since the 1960s. Election Day 2008 proceeded quite smoothly. There were random problems, but we should not be unduly troubled by these revelations. Voting is mostly a human exercise, and humans make mistakes. Voters should be encouraged to register complaints, and election officials should be vigilant about identifying problems. Reasonable remedies should be adopted as quickly as possible. Voting system problems will be tracked and reported under the Commission's certification program. Since November, several election reform bills have been introduced in Congress. The most popular topics seem to be voter registration lists, paper ballots on electronic touchscreen voting systems, deceptive practices, options for days and hours of voting, and improved practices to reduce the time a voter must wait in line. But, of course, that doesn't apply here in your great state. Mr. Chairman, in closing, I again thank the committee for the opportunity to discuss the Help America Vote Act, and I look forward to answering your questions.
So, committee, any questions? We're not hearing many yet.
Go ahead. Yes. I'm not going to get in front of the chair.
Since the Act passed in 2002,
Has the commission seen some, I mean, you've obviously seen a lot of improvements in election systems. Have you seen some of the problems that led to the act being passed? Have you seen clear evidence of some of those problems disappearing or at least becoming less?
Yes, certainly, if for no other reason that some of the older voting systems are not now in use. So you will not find punch card systems being used. For the most part, the lever, the old lever voting systems, have been replaced with the exception of the state of New York. They have not yet replaced the lever systems. HAVA has requirements that mandate things that neither the punch card nor the lever systems could produce, which mainly is a paper trail that can be audited. Secondly, with this voter education has been very important so that people must know when it is they are to vote. They must have easy ways to access information to verify that they're registered to vote. More information is available to voters, and I think as a result of that, some of the problems that were encountered have minimized. But perhaps the key piece is transparency. It is not something that is required in the law, but certainly the Election Assistance Commission has been encouraging election officials to be as transparent in their operations as possible. It's true that never before have so many people been so informed about our election processes since the passage of HAVA.
Understanding, obviously, some of the technical improvements that have occurred, and obviously that punch cards are largely a thing of the past, plus some of the other voting systems you have changed. Not actually commenting on the truth of these allegations, but just the kind of allegations that the public heard about in terms of people being, believing that they were registered and then denied the right to vote when they went to actually vote because of some, circumstances, being careful how I phrase this, that there were just some requirements being put in place that had literally nothing to do with actually them being entitled to vote, but basically hurdles put into place to prevent them from voting.
We are aware that there are voters who felt that their opportunity to vote was being made difficult. We encourage voters, it's a lot of work for the voter, but yes, verify before Election Day that you are registered and know where your precinct is. If you're not on the voter registration list, know your right to a provisional ballot. It's estimated that about 1 million people voted a provisional ballot and had it counted in 2008. The good news is that's 1 million people who are not disenfranchised. The bad news is that, for some reason or other, voter registration lists seem to have dropped the names of a lot of voters. Sometimes it's hard for the voter to know whether it's been a deceptive practice. Has some outside group intentionally provided misinformation to confuse voters? Has it been that a new voter registration system may have possibly dropped the names of some voters? So there are problems. One of the biggest problems is the long wait that people encounter in lines and people feeling that's disenfranchising because, after all, how many people can take 2, 3, or 4 hours to stand in line to vote? Early voting became wildly popular in 2008, and more states now are considering early voting options. It's estimated that about one-third of all voters in 2008 voted by early voting.
Representative Berger.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Hillman, for coming. I note in your remarks that in the last election there was a 62% of eligible Americans voted. I think that's a sort of a shameful number, don't you? Don't you wish it were higher?
Oh, I would agree with you. It is amazing that we celebrate 62% turnout of American citizens who are eligible to vote. And the question is, what can be done to further encourage?
Well, I want to comment on that. Mr. Lindbeck, do you know what our Oregon's voter turnout on the 2008, off the top of your head?
Well, if we're talking about percentage of registered voters, we were at...
Well, is that what we're talking about in this?
Eligible. Eligible. I'm sorry, I'm more familiar with the registered voters number, but it's...
Well, I'm trying to compare apples and apples.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I believe we were in about the 62% category.
So we were right with the national average?
We were like one percentage ahead of the national average, as I recall. I was just reading Oregon's benchmarks this morning, and that's the number that sticks out in my head.
Well, I was going to comment that our vote-by-mail system does better, but clearly it doesn't if we are right there with the same numbers.
Well, it does with your turnout of registered voters. Oregon's turnout of registered voters is higher, significantly higher than the national average. The key is getting people to be registered.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you'll look, because I have an expert here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, and I would like to point out that Oregon... our voter turnout was third in the country. So that proves the comment you're trying to make.
Yeah, which was the point I was trying to make. But I think that one of the issues that you bring up earlier in this discussion is the voter registration list. And you mentioned you have to have a good list. It has to be accurate. It has to be, they have to be real voters. And you mentioned that this is one of the problem areas with HAVA, that not all states have done that. And in a way, I think that speaks a lot to our high percentage as much as our vote by mail. The vote by mail requires that we have a good list. Mm-hmm. And I am sorry in your remarks that some of these other states are clearly from this, that that's an area that needs more work, and I think we ought to be at that, don't you?
We would agree. I think some states underestimated the amount of work that goes into building databases and producing lists. And then, of course, there are the match requirements for newly registered voters to determine that, in fact, a person's registration is eligible. But it's a challenge. I also think the flip side of that is some of the voter registration procedures are making it a bit more complicated and complex than it should be, and that leads to a certain amount of confusion. For example, when outside groups do voter registration, the mantra is, if you don't know for sure you're registered, register anyhow. Better that you be registered twice than not registered at all. Well, then, of course, duplicate registrations create an administrative exercise for the election officials. But from the voter's perspective, if I don't know 100% that I am registered, if I don't have that confidence, if it's not easy for me to look online to make sure that I'm registered to vote, then I probably would register just to be on the safe side to make sure that I'm on the list.
Mr. Chair, thank you for this. Thank you for this discussion. Because I would agree with you, but the danger is you vote twice or somebody registers. It requires that this list be accurate and vetted, or you have the possibility for abuse. People who can say, well, we can register the Rajni seat. Kate, I'm thinking of, we have had an incident years ago in our state of people trying to sort of game this system. So I think one of the key pieces of HAVA that I like and have always liked is it forces other states to address what Oregon has had to come to early with our mail system, which is the database, and how clean and accurate it is sort of the key piece for all voters, those who want to register and want to be part of the system, and keeping fraud out of the system. It's sort of a central piece, and I appreciate HAVA's sort of attention to this and bringing other states to where we might be in terms of that. And also, one more comment. All those states that are doing early registration, well, that's what we do.
Early voting.
Representative Durant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hillman, welcome to Oregon.
Thank you.
Is there any kind of difficulty with the prompt removal of deceased names from the rolls?
I would think the only difficulties that jurisdictions would encounter is the exchange of information between the bureau or department that has the information about people who have died and the election official. When it can be verified that, in fact, we are looking at a list of deceased people, it's just the amount of time for the exchange of the information from the appropriate department.
Representative Devlin. Senator Devlin, that's fine.
I do believe some of that has been addressed in the state due to the state voter file. I mean, I would think that you're doing some of those checks now. The other circumstance that we would have had before was that a person would move from one county to the next and be registered in both counties. And obviously, I think with the state voter file, you should be able to detect those kind of things. I don't know which ones we check. Some we check against death certificates in terms of the registry. I don't know if we check in dissolutions in terms of changes of name or that. But there are some things about voter registration files that can never be perfect because, in my mind, it would require too much intrusion into people's private lives for them ever to be entirely perfect. We don't know when someone decides that they're going to move to Washington. I mean, we might have them on the voter files for another year or so, but we don't require people to, you know, to check in their papers when they leave the state and go to Washington. You know, there's just a lot of things that would require a level of intrusion into people's private lives if you wanted the registration files to be absolutely perfect.
Mr. Chair, in terms of the address update information, in 2008 we passed Senate Bill 1098, which allows essentially the clerks to update the address when someone moves within a county. Obviously, if we move forward with the online voter registration legislation, which we're hoping you will do, that will also assist with folks being able to. That will just enable folks to change their address online and help keep the database as accurate as possible. And then I'd like Mr. Lindback to respond to the process for, shall we say, purging and updating the rolls to make sure that folks that are no longer with us aren't on the rolls.
Thank you. John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. We, of course, especially with a federal person here in the room, we, of course, follow the National Voter Registration and federal law to the letter in regards to when and
etched
how.
On your forehead.
When and how voters can be removed from the voter registration list. Obviously, that's a very delicate subject because some states have gotten in trouble for purging voters from lists before they are allowed to do under law. Our centralized voter registration system is configured to assist the counties with catching things like duplicate registrations. As they're inputting a registration from a voter, the system automatically goes out and looks for duplicates. And someone with the same name, the possible duplicate registrations appear on the screen, and the person who is inputting that information can compare everything, including signatures. And so that is a continual process that we have built into the system. We also, under state law, in terms of voters who are deceased, information is received from the state, and county clerks also receive information from their counties in regards to deaths. Sometimes it's the same information. The state information comes later. The county information comes earlier. Clerks are also allowed to cancel a registration when they see an obit and can match the obituary in the newspaper with a voter registration record on file. Those are the current sources that we have. There's been various points of discussion about whether or not we should be using the Social Security Death Index. We found in a quick little check after someone was challenging us on that prior to the election, filed a letter with our office that suggested that there were a lot of voters who were deceased who had received ballots. We called some of those voters, and indeed some of them were deceased. It's certainly no surprise that that you have voters who have died and the information hasn't caught up yet to the county at the time that you issue the ballots. But we also found on this list of supposedly deceased people from the Social Security Administration that about 40% of them were very much alive when we made the phone calls. So the list is not accurate, and so we have some work to do before we sort of jump into the idea of using the Social Security Death Index as a reliable source of information for deaths. Hmm. And that's the kind of issue that you get into when you start looking at this issue of what you can do, whose registration can be canceled and when, and you always must consider sort of the federal law. For example, you are not allowed to remove anybody from the voter registration list 60 days prior to an election. That's sort of one part of our law here.
Questions on this other side? We have, I want to share opportunities. Okay, then we had some passionate constituents come forward and ask about, one person clearly stated, when you're born here and you grow up here and you live here, you shouldn't have to do anything. You should get to vote. I mean, he was he was just like, I've lived here my whole life. I should get to vote. Why do I have to go do something to prove I've grown up here, lived here, and whatever? And then other people who are really uptight about people being fraudulent with respect to sending in information. So we have you seen other states where you see that balance being very good, things that we could look at? And you're looking around. We have somebody here that's been all over the country. So on ensuring that opportunity for people who are truly citizens and really have that right to vote, get the right to vote.
Understanding that we are in a country where we have one state that has no voter registration, we have a couple of states, probably more than two, that have same-day voter registration, which means on Election Day you can show up and register to vote. And then we have states that have procedures that require proof of citizenship and a state-issued photo identification card to be able to register to vote. The conversations now go along the line of, I hate to use the term universal voter registration because it triggers some emotional responses, but shouldn't everybody who's a citizen just be automatically considered registered to vote? And then you've got groups who understand the complexities of that kind of a system and gravitate towards same-day voter registration. I think what we have working in our favor, or when I say we, I mean the country, states in particular, is technology. That as the statewide voter registration databases mature, and as states use them and work out the glitches, and as those databases are able to communicate with other state databases to check for duplications, I think we will see opportunities for voter registration procedures to change so that people can perhaps do same-day voter registration without at all altering the integrity and the quality of the system. And that usually there's a period of time following Election Day that the officials check, usually by signature, to make sure that, in fact, the person who showed up on Election Day to register is that person and is eligible to vote. And I appreciate the concerns that people have about abuses of the system and perhaps voter fraud. What I have seen in my time on the commission is that the number of instances of voter fraud are relatively, I would almost use the term minuscule, compared to the numbers of people who are both eligible to vote as citizens and the numbers of people who were registered. What happens for the voter is that the line between the administration of elections and campaigning gets blurred, and some of the what I call political shenanigans, which is sort of manipulating the system to give a candidate an advantage. To the voter, they don't know the difference between what I as a candidate am doing and what John Lindbeck as an election administrator is doing. So the more we educate voters, the more information we provide, the more transparent the system, the more open the offices, the more the voters can see, they will be able to discern what their rights as voters are. And every voter wants to protect their right to vote. They want to protect the rights of their fellow citizens to vote. Nobody wants to see the system undermined by fraud, abuse, and shenanigans. But there are people who will do what they feel they have to do to win. So I think that in this country, in a few years from now, we should be able to see technology used as a great system and a great device to allow people to be able to register to vote in the easiest possible ways and still maintain the integrity of the voter list. Sorry for the long answer.
I love the long answer. and the next one is, HAVA has these expectations they're trying to get to, and part of the deal is with the federal government, the way we encourage that is by allowing there to be money to use. Are there any of the states that have chosen not to get involved with HAVA and accept any of the money?
One state did, and I'm not so sure they understood what they were doing, and that was Connecticut. For whatever reason, Connecticut did not accept monies to replace their voting equipment, and then they found out that they had to. But every state accepted the larger payment. Connecticut came to the realization too late that they could have taken the money and used it to replace the equipment they were going to have to replace anyhow. So, no, every state has. I think on that subject, Congress should continue to be reminded that it has not fully appropriated all the HAVA dollars. And at the beginning of the implementation of HAVA, states developed their plans based on the expectation that they would get full funding. And that hasn't happened yet and has required states to adjust their plans so they could be in compliance. So I think it's very important for Congress to realize that while they've given a significant amount of money, I mean, $4 billion is not an insignificant amount of money, but still, if you put together a plan that was based on $400 million and you only got $350 million, well, $50 million is a lot of money for a lot of states. But I think the good news in some of this is that the HAVA dollars are there for states to continue to use to be compliant with the law. The interest earned on that, as I said earlier, stays with the state, is eligible to be used on HAVA dollars. So states that still have HAVA dollars can continue their work to be in compliance, and that's a little bit protected in this era of deep financial concerns that the whole country is facing.
And the other one, you mentioned shortly about the paper trail, and that is part of what HAVA expects. But there are a group of states that still don't have a paper trail. Is that correct?
Well, there are two kinds of paper trails. The one that HAVA doesn't mandate what that paper trail looks like. So where the controversy came up is that the voter was not able to verify on a piece of paper how he or she voted. The paper record was internal to the machine. And so you could take that out for audit purposes, and you could see every single transaction that happened on that machine during the course of the time that it was used. It's just that I, as a voter, wouldn't be able to see a verification. That, of course, it's almost a little bit of a domino effect, because that then bumps up against the accessibility requirements with respect to persons who are blind or sight impaired being able to confirm and verify what their vote was. The manufacturers are beginning to step up to the line. I mean, they understand that they have the ability to produce machines that can serve the voters as the voters need to be served. Earlier this afternoon, I had an opportunity to see what the state of Oregon is doing to come up with a device to assist persons with disabilities. And from the vantage point that I've seen, these systems can service any voter that may have a desire to use a machine that helps them, whether the person has severe arthritis, whether it's an older person that may have a little a problem with dexterity, or if it's a person whose literacy level is challenging and could benefit from hearing the information on the ballot read to them. And it's a very user-friendly system, and I think it's one that should serve the voters of the state very well.
And I know that the audit is currently going on, as you mentioned, but during the election season, were there any, you get calls, or I would expect you guys get calls from all over the country about kinds of issues.
Oh, yes.
Any issues that popped up from Oregon that we should be aware of?
None that were called to our attention.
No, seriously,
you should be very proud. There were none that were called to our attention. If anything, the rest of the country says, vote by mail. When I first started on the commission, it was, they do what? They vote by mail? How do they protect against fraud? Without appreciating the point that Representative Berger made, which was that when you do that, that you have to have a list with integrity, and the mail, if it can't be delivered, would be returned. Is there an opportunity for somebody to abuse the system? Human beings will abuse anything if that's their motivation. You know, no matter what system you put in place, somebody is busy trying to figure out how to manipulate that system. I mean, I guess that's human nature. And perhaps that's what leads to, you know, creative technology or other things. But you should be very proud that Oregon has done very well. And I think without the lines, I mean, that alone, if you take out of the equation, I have to stand in line for 3 or 4 hours to vote. If you take out of the equation, you're not sure if it's fair that polling place X gets 8 machines and polling place Y, my polling place only has 3. Or the work required to recruit people to work the polls on election day. I mean, we need almost 2 million people on election day to help carry out the elections. And for the most part, these are volunteers who receive a stipend. So you've got 3 big administrative issues off of your table, and I think that helps a lot.
We do too.
Yes, we do, actually. Yeah. Other questions from anyone? I'm seeing none.
And can I also say, as I think about the geography, so the state of Washington is going vote by mail. Many counties in Northern California, and so the states that are contiguous to. I think if we took Oregon and put it in the middle of the South, we probably would see states down there, once observing your process and your results, wanting to see how they could benefit from a similar process. So we may geographically move you around.
And I will tell you that those of us who have children who go geographically to other places go out and find out, how do I do an absentee ballot? Because they can still vote by mail in a whole lot of these other states.
Right.
And it's hard for them to understand that they aren't sending it to them, so they have to figure out their own way to get there. But they just don't understand why these other places don't let them vote the way they're supposed to be able to vote. It's really, that was actually a funny thing.
Well, I think that people under age, maybe under age 40, certainly under age 35, aren't going to wait too much longer to want to know why they can't vote this way.
Yeah.
A little device
already
in hand of avoiding my next appointment. Why do I have to do it other way? So I think we will see an evolving change going on.
Online voter registration, we had a very large group of young people here who didn't. First, they had a hard time finding a stamp in order to mail anything in. Secondly, they couldn't understand when they had this piece of paper in front of them, filling it out was very abnormal. It was better to be on a screen, and that they needed it to be the right place, and it was really hard for them to do that, and they were hopeful that we would consider their ideas of having online voter registration. Senator Devlin, I'll get there eventually, Senator.
When vote by mail came in, over the years we've made several adjustments, and we have adjusted a little bit the window for ballots to be put out, but we've made it about as narrow, I think, as practical. And one of the reasons why, I mean, it's not as if you don't have to make adjustments that fit your state, is we do still have areas in the state that do not have daily mail service. So we have to allow adequate time. I was wondering if either the Secretary or you could comment on the recent news story about the Postal Service potentially deciding not to deliver mail on Tuesdays, which just would make our system a little bit difficult. Unless you would like our presidential results announced on Monday before the election.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, for the record, Kate Brown, Secretary of State. My office did send a letter to the Postmaster General, and I have received a letter in response, which I'd be happy to get to the committee. One of the options, as they are trying to compete in this very economically competitive environment, was to look at reducing mail service one day a week. I think they were mostly looking at the summer time frame when there was lighter mail season, but I did send off a letter saying, please don't do Tuesdays. That would make our vote by mail not work, and they're like, no, back down. So I think they weren't really looking at it in November of election years. The other issue would be May as well. If we were to take a look at moving our primary a couple weeks later, we'd certainly want to have the conversation with them. But my sense in the letter I received from the Postmaster General, as well as a visit from folks in the United States Postal Service, is they're not moving forward on this as a last-ditch option, and it would likely only be during the summertime.
I think from a national perspective, you can go any place in this country, certainly 2 weeks out of a month, and find an election going on, if not every week. And so I think the Postal Service will be challenged, because no matter what scheme it came up with, some state is going to be affected. Some states allow absentee ballots to be returned on election day, and they depend heavily on the post office to make that last delivery on election day. The mailing out of the ballots or the forms to request a ballot, all of that information is time sensitive, and so the post office needs to be educated that when it makes that decision, and we respect the right of the Postal Service to make a decision that allows it to operate efficiently, but it has consequences on the economics of some other jurisdiction in terms of how they are able to conduct their election. So I think there's going to be a lot of pushback on that. And then you'd say, well, what about Saturdays? Well, Louisiana votes on Saturdays. So their non-federal elections are held on Saturdays. So,
and Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, we did alert the National Association of Secretary of States as well about this issue and sent them a copy of my letter. So all the secretaries around the nation should be aware of this as an issue.
And I guess the other one, because it's come up, we're going to be dealing with a bill eventually that tries to put some stuff together that once we find these anomalies, and one has to do with when you have to send your ballots out to the military overseas. Is that a federal kind of requirement from everyone?
Yes.
The timeline and all
that? There is a federal timeline, and it really affects states that have late primaries. I mean, states that have September primaries can almost never meet it. We are doing a study with the Election Assistance Commission with the National Institute of Standards and Technology to look at the use of the Internet for military and overseas ballots. And in many ways, that perhaps will be a pilot for the use of the Internet for voting in other areas of the country. There are places in this country that are ready to start with Internet voting. It's the security issues that people are most confronted with over that.
Yeah, the issue, I think, at times with that one is that we also pass these laws that say we have to have voter pamphlets out by a certain time, and then we have to correct our voter pamphlet if it, you know, somebody dies or something along the way. And then we've already mailed half of them, or a group of them, because the military got them this time, our voters get them this time. So even in our wonderful system, which I really do think is the way to go, we still have these issues about how do we get the right information to the voters who are going to vote on a timely manner.
Well, when we think of the complexities of voting, I mean, you just think about different deadlines, and whether it's, you know, filing deadlines and mailing deadlines, and, you know, I think that the system as it works, and it's probably better to say the 50 systems as they work across the country, work remarkably well, because you are still dependent on human beings to perform the functions. Somebody has to, you know, make sure that the information is inputted and double-checked and corrected, and, you know, you're depending on the postal person to deliver the mail, or in the case of overseas, FedEx stepped in and said, we will deliver the ballots if the overseas people could get it to the FedEx facility. So you're right. The dates get to be very tricky. You change one date, then you've got to look at the multiple effect on other steps in the process.
And I think the other thing that has happened over time is that we think of numbers, because we've heard them a lot, that they can't really be that big. And so a million is nothing like it used to be when I was a kid. And yet if you actually sat down and started counting there, it would take you a long time.
Yes.
So
yes.
And then we talk about the 100 million or however many people are going to cast a vote. The fact that they actually get counted on the same day is pretty remarkable, even though it takes a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yes, I know. I'm more than a day.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're counting 140 million. I mean, when you really look at it, though, you think about it and you say, okay, let's assume 40 million people voted early in 2008. So that means across the United States, 100 million people were showing up at thousands of different polling places. You had 2 million volunteers who received somewhere between 4 and 8 hours of training as poll workers. You've got over 7,000 election jurisdictions. I mean, the numbers of things going on, I don't think there is any other activity in this country that has that many people engaged in that many different places using many different kinds of voting systems, all happening on one day.
And it's really, multiply that by the number of people on the ballot, and
yes,
it's all, and the number of issues that are on the ballot.
Yes.
And it's a lot of counting.
Yes. Yes. But there are some jurisdictions that still use paper ballots. That are, you know, good old-fashioned Mark the X paper ballot.
And we've had opportunities on every election to find out how long it takes if people have to look at each one, whether it be in Washington not long ago or wherever. And
right.
It's pretty remarkable. So, other questions? Seeing none, I want to thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
And is there any other business? I want to remind the committee, at least, that we are meeting this Friday on the 20th. Okay, so the people remember that. And with that, I will, if there's no further business, we'll adjourn our committee and we can spend some time. Thank you.
Thank you
again very much.
Thank
and thank you for coming over.